Steve Bannon was saying to the Wall Street Journal this morning, which was that, you know, the MAGA base doesn't like this stuff in Iraq or Iran, but it doesn't mind this stuff in its own hemisphere because it can be sold as a kind of domestic intervention, or at least an intervention that, has clear domestic reasons for taking place.
And so do you think that this doctrine is now going to spread across other parties, or is it very much confined to Donald Trump, to the Republican Party? Or do you, you know, because there have certainly been parts of Donald Trump's first term, the protectionism that lasted into the Biden term, and he carried it over into his second term. Do you think that the Donroe doctrine is here to stay, that we'll still be talking about that in 30 years' time?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure the name will stick, particularly amongst Democrats, but I certainly think, I mean, one of the reasons the Monroe Doctrine has been invoked so frequently over the years is that it is a very flexible doctrine. Oh. And I can certainly see, I can't see a situation where Democrats invoke it in the same way Trump does, but I can certainly see the Democrats.
I committed a broadcasting sin. I asked you a very long question and I didn't give you enough time to answer it. But thank you so much indeed for joining me, Doctor. And that is it from me today. My producer was Lizzie Highfield and Ryan Boyden was the technical operator. I'll be back tomorrow from 1 p.m. if they let me. Up next is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much. It's 2 o'clock. You're listening to Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
And coming up on our programme today, should the UK rejoin the EU single market? The Prime Minister thinks it's preferable over a customs union. We're going to speak to our favourite EU big brain, Catherine Barnard. We'll ask how bad Venezuela's drug trade problem really is and why it's led to the removal of its president. Should Botox be classed as high risk? Beauty industry leaders are calling for stricter rules around fillers and cosmetic procedures. Robbie Millen will join us in our first literary salon of the year, and money man Adam Shaw will tell us just before 4 o'clock how to grab ourselves an early bird bargain when booking that summer break.
Let's start with the news at 2 o'clock. Stuart Willey.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Venezuela's president Nicolás Maduro has been transported to a New York court to face drug charges after being taken from Caracas by US forces on Saturday. Pictures show him handcuffed and surrounded by armed officers. It comes as the country's interim leader Delcy Rodriguez is due to be sworn in. Donald Trump has suggested elections to replace her are not a priority. The Sunday Times' columnist Mark Urban doesn't think that will satisfy Washington for long.
If you just leave the whole infrastructure in place of, you know, ministers, generals, regional governors, who are all, as they say in Venezuela, chavistas, adherents of the former president Hugo Chavez, well, yeah, they're not really going to cooperate with this idea. I mean, can you imagine, you know, allowing in all the American oil companies, as we heard Trump talking about on the plane? I mean, that is their ultimate sort of gringo imperialist nightmare.
Meanwhile, the Prime Minister says Greenland will decide its own future as Donald Trump renews his calls to bring it under American control. The US President has insisted they need it for national security reasons, prompting a strong response from Greenland and Denmark. Sir Keir Starmer said the Danish PM was right to stand up to Trump.
Denmark is a very close ally of the UK, both in Europe and in NATO, and it's very important that we're clear about the principles applicable to here. Greenland and the Kingdom of Denmark must determine the future of Greenland and nobody else.
The Duke of Marlborough has denied strangling his estranged wife. 70-year-old Charles Spencer Churchill is accused of striking and intentionally strangling Edla Marlborough 3 times in 18 months. He indicated he'll plead not guilty when he appears in court again next month. A former history teacher who pretended to be a Navy admiral has pleaded guilty to wearing military uniform without permission. 64-year-old Jonathan Carley was charged after attending a remembrance ceremony in North Wales last November. He's been fined £500. 10 people have been found guilty for cyberbullying the French First Lady Brigitte Macron. It was based on false claims she's a transgender woman and comparing her 24-year age gap with the president to pedophilia. A man's in a stable condition after being shot in southeast London. Police were called to Bexley Heath in the early hours of Sunday morning. A 35-year-old man's been arrested on suspicion of attempted murder. In sport, Ruben Amorim's 14 months in charge of Manchester United have ended after he was sacked following a breakdown with the club's hierarchy. He suggested he would leave at the end of his contract and wanted to work as a manager, not head coach, following their 1-1 draw at Leeds. Amorim leaves with United sixth in the Premier League. These fans told Sky Sports News they're not surprised at the decision.
You can't have those kind of results and just kind of come up against your superiors in that way.
It's a total mess at Old Trafford. Both of these two parties are completely culpable in what's happened.
There were just too many games where the level wasn't good enough.
For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Hello, good afternoon. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here until 4 o'clock. Can we be just about the last people to wish you a very happy new year? All eyes on Venezuela, of course. The former president has been transferred from a detention centre to a court in New York. He's due in court in New York at about 5 o'clock our time, so John Pienaar will guide you through that. Meanwhile, we are waiting for the former vice president to be sworn in. She hasn't quite yet, we don't think. After 3 o'clock, we're going to talk to a professor of law and justice about what is going on in Venezuela and what has motivated the Trump administration to act in the way that it has. Prince Harry, they're saying he's got his arm protection back when he comes to the UK. Why is that? We'll talk Botox, butt lifts and fillers. They should be considered high-risk treatments, according to the beauty industry. We've had everything, haven't we, both?
We have, yes.
Much good it's done either of us. No, I mean, Fee looks absolutely ravishing.
And your butt lift's amazing.
Thank you, Vanessa.
Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Manchester United has said goodbye to another manager. Ruben Amorim has gone. This now means the club's had six permanent bosses since Fergie and four interims. Who is going to be next in the hottest of all footballing seats? We'll talk about that a bit later. And the Times literary editor, Robbie Millen, will discuss a new novel by Lionel Shriver. And he'll revisit some wonderful classics as well in our literary salon after 3:30. And then we end the programme today with some personal finance with Adam Shaw, holiday finance today. It's actually a beautiful day, isn't it, in central London today? But it is very, very chilly.
It is. And across the rest of the country, we know that you're experiencing some very severe weather conditions. Snow. People up in Aberdeenshire and Carmarthenshire have not seen the like of it for about 10 years. So it's properly, properly chilly. So when we say, ha ha, it's beautiful and sunny, feel free to throw something at your radio. We do understand you may be experiencing some pain. Shall I do the most read stories on the Times website so far this afternoon?
Yeah, you can do. Just let's alert everybody. The fact they can contact us. 0333 003 2353 is, as ever, the WhatsApp.
So, in at number three, how fake Admiral posed as a war hero for years. Jonathan Carley convinced friends that he had a glittering service record. Today he's pleaded guilty after provoking outrage at a Remembrance Sunday event last year. The second most read story is all about Venezuela. We will talk about that after 3 o'clock. The Times' live page is up, so you can read all of the very latest updates there. And the most read piece on the Times website is about Amorim, sacked as Manchester United head coach. He was sacked after his relationship with the club's hierarchy broke down, and we'll talk about that in this hour of the programme too. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You do need your digital subscription. If you didn't get one as a Christmas present, have a word with those people who say that they're your loved ones and get one yourself. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe. It's 7 minutes past two. So let's look at our own position with the European Union as we start this hour of the programme. We're going to start to feel richer from this year, so says Keir Starmer, who's been out and about in Reading for his first visit of 2026. One area the Prime Minister hopes will help with that is this growing closeness to the EU. The PM said yesterday he believes it's in the country's interest to get closer to the single market.
If you look at the deal we've already done with the EU on food and agriculture, we're aligning our rules so that we can access the single market. So that's a sovereign decision that we've made as a government that is in our interest to do so. What I'm saying is there are other areas where we should consider whether it's in our interest to do the same and align with the single market. Now, that needs to be considered on a sort of issue-by-issue, sector-by-sector basis. But we've already done it with food and agriculture, and that will be implemented this year. That will be another turning-the-corner moment.
Well, Keir Starmer has ignored calls from the Lib Dems to re-enter the customs union. Let's talk to Catherine Barnard, Professor of European Law at Cambridge University. How much of an advantage would moving closer to the EU actually provide? Can we try and put some real facts and figures on this, Catherine?
It's such a difficult question to answer because nobody really knows. Let's just break it down into stages. You might recall that Wes Streeting, the health secretary, has said we should rejoin the customs union. And that probably would make a really quite significant difference, probably about 3 to 4% of GDP, which would be about 100 billion euros. So it's really quite significant sums of money. But as you heard, Keir Starmer's not keen on that because he says, rightly, that because we've done trade deals elsewhere, therefore we would have to give up those trade deals. However, the trade deals with Australia and New Zealand scarcely shift the dial in terms of money. So the question is really what he's so excited about. Now, then he starts to use what I would say is rather slippery language about access to the single market, because every country in the world has access to the single market. It's very different from being a member of the single market. And the single market, you'll recall, has the four freedoms at its core: free movement of goods, free movement of people, the controversial one, free movement of services and free movement of capital. And he's not actually talking about rejoining the single market, he's just talking about access. And there, what he seems to be talking about, the various things that were provisionally agreed back in May.
What about future deals, Catherine? How might they affect that line between the customs union's appeal and the single market's appeal? Is there something clever that the Labour government can be doing at the moment that would future-proof us if we did manage to do bigger deals with other people?
No, this is a big problem. It's a bit like being pregnant. You can't be a bit pregnant. You're either in a customs union or you're not. Now, the area where there might be a bit of wriggle room is in respect of goods versus services. So the customs union is about goods and it doesn't cover services. So we could be in the customs union and do deals with non-EU states, with the US or Australia or Canada, in respect of services. And actually, services are 70, 80% of the economy. So you could say, actually, we could be in the customs union or in a customs union with the EU in respect of goods, but still do our own deals in respect of services. The problem is, the trade deals that have been done with India and with Australia and New Zealand are mainly about goods, because services are really tricky, because all countries have different rules about services. Just think about it. If I want to practice as a lawyer in another country, it's all very well to say I'm a brilliant English lawyer, but the French will say, so what? You know nothing about French law. And that's the same across all of the professions. And that's created a real problem. One of the things that Keir Starmer has said is that we should do a deal on recognition of qualifications with the EU. It's so difficult to do because of the fact that the qualifications are different in other countries.
Tell us a little bit more about the legal perspective around all of this. I mean, that's absolutely your skill set. Here comes a whopping question for you, Catherine. How close can Keir Starmer get to the single market before it does need some kind of legal ribbon around it?
So, there's lots of, as a lawyer would say, lots of legal questions there. But essentially, any arrangement we do for example, about rejoining the EU's electricity market or doing something in respect of sanitary and phytosanitary, that's what Keir Starmer was talking about, so food, drink, will probably require some form of agreement between the two sides. And then that agreement will have to be implemented in the UK. There'll have to be an Act of Parliament to give effect to that agreement. And then there will need to be powers given to the executive via statutory instruments, so secondary law, so to give effect to what's known in the jargon, wait for it, of dynamic alignment. And dynamic alignment is the jargon term for the UK keeping up to speed with all of the latest EU rules on food, for example, or on electricity. And the what we see in the paperwork that's already been published, there was quite an interesting document for nerds like me that was published just before Christmas about the electricity market, is it's all dependent on dynamic alignment. It's also dependent on money. And the UK making a suitable, note the how much heavy lifting that word's doing, financial contribution to the EU. So every time we do a sector-specific deal, what Keir Starmer was talking about, it will come with some significant strings attached.
OK, so what does suitable and significant actually mean? Can you give us just a ballpark figure there?
Nobody knows. Absolutely nobody knows. But what we do know is that the financial contribution that was required to participate in SAFE, SAFE is the acronym for the defence loan scheme, was considered just too high. And therefore, the UK did not participate in SAFE. And that was seen as one of the easier wins for the UK. If we couldn't agree on that, it's going to make it very difficult to agree in respect of any deal on SPS. The one thing that we do know is that the UK has signed an agreement over Erasmus Plus. And Erasmus Plus, you'll remember, is where students can go and study in universities in other EU states and vice versa. The price tag there was pretty significant, about $500 million a year.
Right. How much of this dynamic alignment is exactly what David Cameron tried to get from the EU before the Brexit vote, or are they two completely different things?
Yeah, they're rather different. So what David Cameron tried to do in the so-called new settlement deal that he came up with was basically to try and get an emergency break on the number of EU nationals coming to the UK in quite complex situations. What when we were a member state of the EU, we did dynamically align. But of course, the big difference then was that we were involved in the discussions of the content of the legislation. Now we're out. We have a role as a decision shaper. Nobody knows what that means, but we certainly have no role in the adoption of EU legislation. So we have much, much less say.
Right, I want to be a decision shaper, don't you? That, for me, Catherine, is up there with thought leader. How do other EU countries view Keir Starmer's current EU creep?
Look, some countries are very supportive and want to have the UK much closer to the EU. You're thinking Germany in particular. Excuse me. The French, on the other hand, are not keen.
I think we may have lost Catherine there, or maybe it was just a very simple French fact. We could just leave it at that. Before we let you go, Catherine, I just want to ask your thoughts about what might happen with Denmark in its row with Donald Trump over Greenland. What do you expect from Keir Starmer and from the EU leaders over that? And when do they need to start making their voices a little bit more amplified?
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because Keir Starmer is caught between his bromance with Donald Trump and at the same time with his concern about international law and the respect for the rules of the international legal order. The EU are really going to have to take some very difficult decisions about how loudly they want to shout to protect Denmark. The statements that have come out have been very measured so far. Of course, it depends whether Donald Trump is absolutely serious, or the signs are that he is. And if the EU does not have a coordinated response, this really does mark a very serious position for the EU going forward, because to lose a part of one of the sovereign state's territory would be dramatic and has never happened before.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem extraordinary, really extraordinary, to be standing on the sidelines watching this. Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon. Catherine Barnard is Professor of European Law at Cambridge University. We kind of know the situation that we're watching at the moment, don't we, Jane, when we see Keir Starmer, other EU leaders make measured responses. It is the fear of the playground bully. It's not wanting to goad an aggressive person into more aggressive action. But I think the point that Catherine Barnard made there, just about how incredible it would be if within plain sight there was a land grab that close to Europe and European connections, what will we find ourselves saying on the morning that we wake up to find that Greenland's gone?
Oh, God.
Welcome back.
5 days into 2026. We're all absolutely exhausted. Can't believe it. I think we're going to be on slightly firmer ground in a couple of minutes when we talk about our royals. And Prince Harry may now get his wish for armed protection in the UK. Could it, will it lead to a reconciliation with his father, the King? It is almost 20 minutes past two. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrund and Patrick Maguire.
This very important geopolitical decision hinged on a guy in a cupboard with nil intercession by anybody.
No party loyalty, just the inside track on the decisions and policymakers that shape your life. The State of It is available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
What's the feeling you get at David Lloyd Clubs? Well, let's just say that when you've experienced the tranquility of our spas, felt the feel-good intensity of a workout class, enjoyed your little one's happy faces, making friends in the kids' club, and relaxed together as a family in our club rooms, this radio ad won't be the only thing on air. Elevate your everyday with David Lloyd Clubs. Try a 3-month membership today. Terms and conditions apply.
At Aberdeen Investment Trusts, we create more ways for your money to work harder. Whether you're looking to tap into global markets or target specific goals at any stage of life, we have options for you. With Aberdeen, our investment knowledge and experience become yours. Search Aberdeen Investment Trusts online to learn more. When investing, please remember that your capital is at risk.
Issued by Aberdeen Fund Managers Limited.
Incredible snorkeling!
Carnival!
Sunrises and sunsets.
Grilled lobster.
Hobby cats and kayaking.
Morning swim.
Pina coladas.
Serene spas.
If you love the sound of a Caribbean holiday, then Sandals have every little thing covered. Do it all or do nothing at all. Your perfect holiday is waiting at sandals.co.uk. Sale now on. Atoll protected.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Let the design and installation experts at Wix help transform your home. Get started by booking a free kitchen or bathroom design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Let's talk about Harry. Prince Harry may have won his fight to get back his taxpayer-funded armed security when he comes to the UK. Now, if this move is confirmed, it could lead to his children seeing the King for the first time in years. They are his grandchildren, after all. This comes after the Duke of Sussex wrote to the Home Secretary in September after an incident with a stalker who had previously made online threats against him. Let's have a word with Kate Mansey, assistant editor and royal editor for The Times. So, Kate, what's brought this about exactly?
Well, this is a long-running saga, as you well know. So it's been 4 years since Harry first started legal action against the Home Office to try and have his bodyguards, his police protection reinstated. Yep. Every time he comes to the UK, he said that it was his right and the risk hadn't changed. So when he left official duties, he had all that taken away from him. He said, you know, the risk assessment dropped. obviously we now know that court case was unsuccessful, and then he appealed. That was also unsuccessful. He told the BBC it was a good old-fashioned establishment stitch-up. He was very cross about it. Now, he's written to Shabama Mahmood at the end of last year saying that he wanted a risk management board. So this is where they look at the level of risk against Prince Harry in the UK. He's saying it should never have been taken down. The risk didn't decrease because he was away from official duties. He's still Prince Harry, then the son of the, now the son of the monarch, previously the grandson of the monarch. And from reports at the weekend, it looks like that RMB has been successful, and he's now very confident, it seems, that he's going to have that police security reinstated every time he comes to the UK.
Right, but we haven't had this officially confirmed by anybody.
It's not been officially confirmed by anybody. Team Sussex are saying they don't speak about security, and everyone's been quite cautious about it. But certainly we know we're expecting an announcement this month about the outcome of this latest kind of appeal, if you like, for him to get his security back.
Right. He has made the occasional relatively brief trip to the UK, hasn't he? And what's he done in terms of security on those trips?
So those previous trips, he's had to give kind of 30 days notice, and he will then apply, if you like, to have security each time, depending on what he's doing. And my understanding is every time he's come, he hasn't had that kind of one-on-one police protection. There's been kind of police sweeps, for example, of the hotel where he hosted the Well Child Charity Awards, and sort of policing around the sides. But it will be a matter of his team kind of phoning the British Transport Police, telling them that he's getting on a train and things like that. So he has never actually had that kind of police security since he stepped away.
Right. And there is no doubt that we know there is this stalker. What are we safe to say about any incident involving this individual?
Yeah, so there was an incident with Harry, and we understand that the police were made aware of that. It's what's known as kind of fixated individuals who are known to sort of follow around members of any VIPs, but particularly members of the royal family in some cases. And that will have kind of spooked his team while he was over here without police protection. But there's also other threats against Prince Harry that, you know, a lot of the public don't know about. And while, yes, he did step away from official duties, a lot of people, I think, do have some sympathy with him in terms of having, you know, that risk against him hasn't decreased. You know, he served in Afghanistan for two tours of Afghanistan. In his memoir, Spare, he talked about some of the killing that happened out there. And, you know, his team has always said from the beginning that he shouldn't have had that security taken away.
I mean, whether I have read Spare and I know exactly what you're referring to, and I do think it was an extraordinary admission for him to make, probably not a very wise one, actually, although honest, you could say. He was really putting himself in danger by saying those things, wasn't he?
Well, there was a lot of criticism, wasn't there, at the time about him, you know, saying, well, he's effectively put kind of crosshairs on him, having put that out there.
Which makes it even odder that his protection was taken away.
Well, it's interesting that his protection was taken away. I think some people around him have always seen it as a bit of a punitive measure. Well, you know, if you leave official duties, you know you won't get security. And that was kind of used as a kind of a tool to try to keep him in the fold. He went away regardless. And I think even he was quite surprised that that security was genuinely taken away.
So if he gets it back, if he gets back the protection paid for by us and everybody else listening, does that mean he's likely to come more often? And will his children establish some kind of a relationship with their grandfather?
Yeah, well, they're two really good questions. I mean, he's always said he wants to come back more. So I expect if he does get UK security, he will. Now, looking ahead to later this year and 2027, he's going to be hosting his Invictus Games, his Paralympic-style games for wounded servicemen and women in Birmingham in 2027, in July next year. And he always does a kind of a year ahead, look ahead when he does these things. So we can expect him this July in the kind of 1 year countdown. Now, I'm sure it's one of the biggest things that he's proud of in his work. I expect he would like to bring the Duchess of Sussex and the two children with him. He's always said he wants his children to have some sort of relationship with the king. I mean, whether reconciliation is likely, well, given some of the water under the bridge, it's hard to say.
We've all got families and they're never easy. But do we have any idea whether there is any positivity coming from the other side? Does the king want to restore relations with Harry and Meghan?
Well, it looked like that, didn't it, at the end of 2025. You know, we had that meeting. There was a cup of tea at Clarence House. came a couple of months after Harry's people had met the King's people, and then the pictures of that meeting had been leaked. Then we had the meeting between father and son. It looked like the start of a brilliant reunion. Obviously, King's not been well. But after that, there were sort of various recriminations on both sides. So Harry's lot were upset because details of that meeting had been leaked, and they claimed that the palace was trying to sabotage that kind of fragile relationship with the King and Harry. The palace were then, so they were bemused, they were baffled and kind of saddened by that allegation. So it always seems like it's kind of two steps forward, one step back with this kind of reunion. I'm not sure we can see kind of a huge welcoming and open arms anytime soon. But I think if Harry is determined to come here more often, perhaps slowly but surely, if he's perhaps prepared to apologise. So last year I was told that one of the big sticking points was that Harry was always asking the royal family to apologise to him, and that that would be the start of him, you know, having more of a family connection to them. But that demand quietly got dropped when he realised that was not forthcoming. No. I think what it might need from Harry now is for him to acknowledge that perhaps he has something to apologise for.
It's called a compromise, isn't it, Fee? I mean, we often talk about the noble art of compromise.
Well, after lots of people have had various Christmases with their families, I think everybody has some sympathy with difficulties there. But I think, you know, when it's writ large, I think it was such a missed opportunity after that cup of tea meeting that there was then this kind of public tit for tat after what had happened, which seemed extraordinary to. As a way to sort of go forward and build bridges. But
right. And can we just have a quick word about Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor? He's still in that big house on the Windsor estate, isn't he?
Yes.
He hasn't actually shifted yet.
No, he's due to leave. He's got until October to get out. I mean, if you think he's got lifetimes worth of stuff in there, there's artefacts from the Royal Collection in there. There's obviously negotiations to be had about what state the property's in with regards to what refund, if any, he gets back. It's going to be, any house move is complicated, as you know, but this is more so. I don't think he's in any rush to leave. People close to the King really, really want him out by Easter, I've been told. But let's see how far that goes.
Thank you, Kate. Kate Mansey, assistant editor and royal editor for The Times. What Fee's laughing? Well, it's just family life in the Raw, isn't it?
It is family life in the Raw. I don't think anybody listening is going to be able to conjure up any sympathy for a guy with a very big house who's going to take quite a bit of time to sort through his stuff.
Well, he's got a big teddy bear collection.
Well, he does, doesn't he? But it's stuff like that, isn't it? Where you just think, God, I mean, if he ever tries to play that card, we're not here for it, Andrew. We are not here for it. Right, coming up, what are smartphones and social media actually doing to young people? In their own words, we're going to hear about the play that goes to Parliament this week. That's all after the news. It's just gone 2:30. Here's Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. The ousted Venezuelan president, Nicolás Maduro, has been transported to a court in New York to face drug trafficking charges. Later, the UN Security Council will scrutinise the legality of the US operation to abduct him. Regina García Cano, a reporter for the AP in Caracas, says supporters of the regime remain angry.
They have chanted things like bring back Maduro, also burn American flags, and they have insisted that what the U.S. government did is comparable to a kidnapping. There are many, many people who have remained silent, and that is because of fear of government repression.
Meanwhile, the Prime Minister has again refused to say whether the U.S. operation broke international law, but he did warn that Greenland's future is not for other nations to decide. So Keir Starmer says it's for the island's population and Denmark to decide their future. The U.S. president has suggested he could intervene in more countries after capturing Venezuela's leader on Saturday. A second man's been arrested in connection with a shooting in southeast London. The 34-year-old is being questioned on suspicion of attempted murder. Wintry weather has caused flights to be cancelled at Liverpool, Aberdeen and Belfast airports. Yellow Met Office warnings for snow and ice remain in force across Scotland and northeast and western England. And Barry Manilow's had part of his lung removed following a cancer diagnosis last month. The 82-year-old singer has told followers on social media he's feeling better today. Don't forget you can set the Times News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Every investor has a future in mind, whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
Romantic retreats. Luxury beachfront hotels. Expansive family villas with sensational sea views. Not lots of, just the very best of. Simpson Travel. The magical destinations you love. The personal service you expect. We visit every one of our properties so we can handpick the perfect holiday for you. SimpsonTravel.com. Because your time is precious.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Rated excellent on Trustpilot. Book a free kitchen or bathroom design appointment and start your own excellent home transformation with Wix. Find your nearest showroom and book your appointment at wix.co.uk.
It is now 26 minutes to three. Taking over from us at 4 o'clock will be John Pienaar. John, if anyone had said to you, OK, you're going to return to work on the 5th of January and there'll be a whole new geopolitical situation to consider, would you have said, oh, yeah, that'll be Venezuela?
Well, I tell you what, I would have said I wouldn't have believed it, but except we're past the point of not believing things now. I mean, and what happened just at the beginning of the last weekend was just so enormous, not just a military operation and regime change in Venezuela, but the way it's now been packaged as a change in the whole global order of things. Donald Trump very openly saying this is now about America taking control of the western half of the globe, and talking about moving on Mexico, Colombia, Cuba, just backing the words up with action, because it's now going to be taken much more seriously in the light of what happened on Friday and since then. So trying to sort of look through this, and there's a lot going on, I tell you, by the way. We've got Nicolás Maduro appearing in a New York court this afternoon, I think, while we're on air. The UN Security Council are having their debate on all of this, and in the Commons, Yvette Cooper, the Foreign Secretary, is going to be giving her report to MPs as well. So we're going to be watching all of that, and then just trying to just disentangle it, pull it apart, look at it very, very hard. The British government position, for example. I mean, you can have different views on the legitimacy or lack of legitimacy of what President Trump and the American administration did. I struggle at this moment to quite understand the British position, which is it's not our business. It's an American matter. I mean, France, for example, Macron has been dragged along from appearing to be supportive or not critical to being more critical. But he doesn't say it's none of our business. This is, the British position. Anyway, Jack Straw, the former Foreign Secretary, Labour Foreign Secretary, is going to be joining me, and he, I think, is going to be echoing the government position, so I can explore some of that with him. I've also got Carla Sands, a former US ambassador to Denmark, who I imagine is going to be defending the idea of America wanting Greenland. And I'm going to be talking to Simon Fraser, former head of the Foreign Office, and to a Venezuelan opposition politician, Freddy Guevara. We're going to be talking about that through the programme and from six on Pienaar and Friends.
Looking forward to it, John. An awful lot to try and make sense of starting from 4 o'clock. Now, being able to see where all of your schoolmates are, a phone in every hand from years 3 and 4 onwards, the boundaries of your childhood broken down by adult images. What has social media and the smartphone revolution actually meant to young people? The play Generation FOMO attempts to answer that question with young people's testimony performed verbatim. On Wednesday, it's being shown to MPs in Parliament, and we're joined by the director, Isabel Defoe. Isabel, very good afternoon from us.
Hi there, good afternoon, and thank you for having me.
Well, absolutely our pleasure. Tell us a little bit more about the play, and particularly the verbatim testimony that the play is made from.
So I am a verbatim playwright, so verbatim is where you interview people around a specific topic, you weave those stories together and to create my narrative arc. So nothing that I write is fictional. Nothing comes from my head. It all comes from the interviews. And so with Generation FOMO, I went and interviewed a lot of young people ranging from the age of 10 to 27. So all of Gen Z and a little bit of Gen Alpha as well. And those interviews were really fascinating because, you know, you're getting people like Gen Z, for example, who are looking at their childhood retrospectively and seeing the difficulties that they went through online. It's been really fascinating. The interviews have been really fascinating for
you. Can you just give us a couple of examples of what these young people have said?
Yeah, things like, you know, when they were given a smartphone, the older generation of Gen Z, you know, when they were given a smartphone, there were no restrictions, obviously, because at the time we didn't really know so much about it. So they were saying that they were scrolling all night long because their phones were allowed to be in their bedrooms. And so that results in sleep deprivation, for example, which we know is one of the biggest reasons why young people go to the GP. Another thing young people say to me is the amount of difficult material they consume. You know, by the age of 11, they've all said that they've seen something inappropriate, whether that may be something violent or porn, or, you know, they've all witnessed something inappropriate. And most of them are not going to adults to share this because they're frightened that their phone will be taken away.
Sure. And I think sometimes children, and I mean, we are talking about children, even if, you know, now they're slightly older, I think they find it very difficult to have the words to tell adults what it is that they've seen. So I wonder whether in your interviews and therefore in the play, you're actually including any detailed descriptions of what's been seen, because it is helpful for us as the adults to know.
The play is a real eye-opener for parents and educators. You know, that's been the real thing because, yes, the play does describe what they see. And we have been touring secondary schools around Kent with the play, and we encourage parents to come along and see the show as well. And it produces these great conversations between parents, teachers and students, because the students, they kind of feel like a sense of relief in a way, because suddenly the play is doing their dirty work for them. We have put porn on the table because they have been honest with me, telling me that that's what they're consuming from, you know, from a very young age. And so, for example, by putting things like pornography or unsolicited pictures, you know, then they can have those they can start to have those conversations with their parents, and hopefully their parents will start to understand. You know, we as adults need to understand that we need to support our young people. We've given them the tech. Tech is here to stay. I'm not anti-tech. It's just about learning to help them to navigate it, to give them some boundaries.
Sure. I think it's a very good point to make, actually, Isabel, that if the children and young people have been able to tell you things, knowing that that voice will get heard, but they're not going to be the ones who have to say it in front of adults, that's a little bit of magic, isn't it?
And remember, with verbatim theatre, they are completely anonymous, right? That is why they are able to be so candid with me, is because they know that their voices will be revoiced by actors. So all my actors are young Gen Zers. They're fantastic. They've been with me since the beginning of the project, and they're very passionate about it. But it's not their story. It's those young people I interviewed, but all those interviews are anonymous.
Sure. And I suppose there's an obvious point here, though, isn't there, Isabel, that you're taking the play to Parliament, but actually the people in Parliament, they shouldn't need to see it. They should be across this. They should have been across this a long time ago.
We should have all been across it, right? And we've allowed our children to be online in their bedrooms, you know, under their duvets, scrolling all night long for far too long. And I think that we all need to support MPs, parents, everybody needs to be supportive. And more importantly, we all need to listen to them. You know, a lot of the young people that I've spoken to say that when they do have boundaries, it's a relief. For example, I've asked every single one of them, you know, for those who have a school ban in place, for a mobile phone ban in place in their school, you know, if they were head of school, I asked them, would they remove the ban on phones. Not one of them said they would. They all say to me that the ban on phones in school is like a moment of respite in their day.
Well, that is a good thing and definitely worth our legislators hearing. But then, of course, the huge point, and I don't know whether or not, you know, you'll be able to answer this, but I'm sure that you have thoughts about it, is just, you know, the pressure needs to then be put on the tech companies, doesn't it? They are the people who can stop the images. They are the people who can help these kids.
And also the young people that I've spoken to are angry with the tech companies. They know that they have no attention span, and they know that the tech companies have got their attention span, and they're angry about that. And I feel that you're absolutely right. Someone needs to be held accountable and someone needs to support. And yes, they are, you know, young people are really angry with tech companies.
If you are having a very honest conversation, though, after the play has been touring for a year and it's won lots of prizes and it's been lauded wherever it's gone, and you go back to all of the young people who you interviewed and you said, yeah, it was great, but the tech companies haven't done anything, the government hasn't done anything, what are those young people going to say? Because effectively, Isabel, that is what has been happening for the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I'm just trying to do my bit for them, you know, trying to help do what I can do. And I think it's fantastic that as a small theatre company, we have been invited into Parliament. And this is our biggest audience yet, right? This is our most important audience. This is the one that can make a difference. So fingers crossed that they will all come. Fingers crossed they will really hear those voices and act accordingly.
And do you have one of those messages to the audience before the show starts saying, please switch your mobile phones off?
No, I don't. I really hope that they do, actually. But what I do always explain is I explain what verbatim theatre is, because I think that's really important, you know, that they understand it's not just your average play, that it is verbatim. And I am a true believer that verbatim has the potential to create social change. And I think that makes a difference.
Have you been at all shocked by what the kids have told you? It's a difficult one, isn't it, Isabel, because it's 3:15 in the afternoon. I can't ask you to describe in explicit detail if those young people have told you explicit detail, but sometimes it does feel frustrating. You know, we have these conversations and we're not actually saying very much about what these kids have seen, but does it live in your head somewhere?
Very much, Fee. You know, what's really been important to me as a mother of two children, it's been a real learning experience. You know, these children that I've interviewed have taught me so much, and they have definitely coloured the way we parent our kids around smartphones, for example. You know, had I not been working with these young people, I think I would have given my children a smartphone as well and thought nothing of it, just like most of people around me do, because, you know, no judgment. I didn't know until I started working on this topic, until I started speaking with these young people. And it's really definitely changed, you know, the way my kids are with.
Well, very best of luck. I obviously hope the production continues on its journey of success. It is called Generation FOMO, and that's the director, Isabel Defoe. And we do talk about it all the time, don't we, Jane, without talking about the explicit images that these kids, our kids, are seeing. And perhaps one of the most helpful things that the government could do is to publish somewhere on an open access website a list of the kind of sites that our kids are visiting. Literally, for parents to go click, 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 and see what the kids are seeing. Because I think there's a reluctance, and that reluctance allows us to have a little bit of a kind of rainbows and unicorns attitude.
Yes, a lot of that going on.
And it's not. It's much deeper, and it's in a minor key.
Oh, and I'm glad you mentioned the MPs as well, because when we look at footage of PMQs, for example,
they're scrolling, aren't they?
All scrolling. So they should, I mean, they really do need to start setting an example. I know they're important people and they need to keep in touch with what other people are saying, but do they really need to do it all the time during Prime Minister's questions, for example? I don't think they do. Anyway, I mean, but you're right. We have all been in denial for far too long about the influence of all this on our offspring. I've deleted Instagram. That's been my most recent decision.
And how's that affected your mental health?
Well, I'm no longer buying a lot of elasticated waist trousers that I was constantly being bombarded with images of things like that. I'm actually the better for it, and I've pretty much halved my screen use. use on a weekly basis. You know, you get, is it weekly basis where you get your daily average? And I think mine has now gone down to about 2 hours.
But do you know what Davina's up to?
No, I don't. I haven't got a clue what's going on the world. I was very angry that a friend of mine hadn't been in touch, and then somebody else told me, oh, she's been on holiday. Have you not seen it on Instagram? And I thought, well, no, I haven't. I haven't seen anything on Instagram. It is possible to live without X and Insta. It really is. I'm proof of that, although what kind of a life I'm leading.
You call that living?
Yeah, exactly. Coming up next on Times Radio, Manchester United have sacked another manager. Amorim is out. Who's going to be next in that hot, hot seat? It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
If you could sail anywhere in the world, where would you go? With Oceania Cruises, our small, luxurious ships allow us to dock in boutique ports in 600 stunning destinations. We offer a more immersive experience and a personalized service, creating unique travel memories. From the Caribbean to the Mediterranean and the finest cuisine at sea, it can only be Oceania Cruises. Visit oceaniacruises.com or your travel agent.
Every investor has a future in mind, whether it's seeing your kids through uni or picturing yourself retiring in Tuscany. The hard part can be knowing how to get there. JP Morgan Personal Investing can help you see the path ahead. With our intuitive app, expert support, and 150 years of JP Morgan's investing experience, you can start making more informed investment decisions today. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
He's gone. Ruben Amorim has been fired as manager of Manchester United. He was in charge for just 14 months. The club have said in a statement the decision was made reluctantly, but they did feel it was time for a change. Well, it has to be said the writing was on the wall when Mr. Amorim talked to the media after Manchester United's 1-1 draw with Leeds at the weekend.
I came here to be the manager of Manchester United, not to be the coach. And that is clear. I know that my name is not Tuchel, is not Conte, is not Mourinho, but I'm the manager of Manchester United. And it's going to be like this for 18 months or when the board decided to change.
He sounded pretty fed up even then, and now he's gone. Jay Motti is the host of Stretford Paddock, the Manchester United YouTube fan channel. Hello, Jay. How are you feeling about all this?
Yeah, I think you said it earlier. Another manager gone. It feels like we're in this sort of never-ending cycle of Manchester United managers coming in for a little while, having a bit of an up-and-down time and then getting sacked. And I was hoping that Ruben Amorim was going to break that cycle, but obviously he hasn't. And I was a bit surprised this morning when I heard he'd been sacked. I was at the game yesterday against Leeds, and whilst it wasn't an amazing performance, I didn't think it was one where you go, OK, that's it, the manager's got to go. But then when I heard the post-match interview as I was on my way home, he sounded like someone who'd almost had enough and certainly wasn't on the same page as the rest of the club.
Yeah, he's actually an interesting guy, Ruben Amorim. I'm not a Manchester United fan, but I always rather enjoyed his outspoken nature. Boring, he wasn't. Certainly not if you're an armchair fan who just likes the whole craziness of the whole thing.
No, he was very honest. He'd tell you exactly what he was thinking. And I think that's a bit of a refreshing change for most managers because they sort of play the cards close to the chest where if he wasn't happy, he'd tell you he wasn't happy, if he felt things weren't good enough or if he was happy about something or whatever his mood or his emotions were, he'd share them with you. So you could tell when he was speaking that he was speaking from the heart and that he was a little bit upset at the fact that it appeared he wasn't going to get backed again in January and he felt like we needed reinforcements. And the club have obviously decided it'd be better to get rid of the manager rather than give him more money or spend more money on players that he needs for his system, which has been a big talking point at Manchester United, the system that he likes to play and a system that really and truly hasn't been that successful.
No. What's it been like to watch?
It's been difficult. It's not been very entertaining. Last season was bad, obviously finishing 15th and losing a final to Spurs, which is a pretty, you know, low point for any Manchester United fan. And then this season, we've had some tough times as well, going out of the Carabao Cup to Grimsby and losing at home to 10-man Everton and drawing recently with Wolves. So it's not been the greatest sort of spell, if you will. We've had a couple of good moments. We won at Anfield, we won at the Etihad under Ruben Amorim, but the high points have been few and far between, and I can understand why. It's just the board felt enough was enough, although I'm not quite buying the line. It was just because we're sat in sixth. I think it was more about his outburst and the fact he's not happy with the club, which has led to him being sacked.
Yeah, I mean, no one's bigger than the club, presumably. I think they've proved that over the years, haven't they? But actually, I was looking at the Premier League table and they're only, sixth place and 3 points off the Champions League places. It's not that bad, is it?
No, I think when you look at the context of where we were last season, what was expected this season, I think fifth place might get you Champions League football this season. And we're one place behind that. So it's not that disastrous. I know that's a pretty low bar. I think the issue has been we've dropped far too many points recently against teams we should be beating. You look at Bournemouth, you look at Wolves, you look at West Ham, you look at Everton, who I mentioned earlier. We should be winning those games, especially at Old Trafford. And then you've got this outburst. For me, it's him calling out the sort of the director of football and the board and the owners almost. That's what's really done it for Ruben Amorim. I don't think it's just the results. Although the results haven't been great, I feel like that press conference and also the one before the Leeds game as well, where he was making it clear he wasn't happy about not being back properly, I think that's what's ultimately led to him being sacked.
So we're told that there'll be a caretaker manager until the end of the season. That manager is Darren Fletcher. Now, tell us about him.
Well, he's a bit of a Manchester United legend. Obviously, he was at the club, came through the academy, did very well for the first team, played a lot of games for Manchester United and has been sort of working as a coach. He's recently been in charge of the academy, I think, and the under-21s, and has done well, and he's a popular figure amongst Manchester United fans. Now, as a long-term option, probably not. He hasn't got much managerial experience, but certainly as a short-term option, someone to come in, maybe just steady the ship, get the sort of fans on board and get the players going again. It makes a lot of sense. We've had interim managers in the past who've come from the sort of, been players at the club. We had Michael Carrick, we had Ruud van Nistelrooy. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, of course, was caretaker before he became permanent manager. So this makes a lot of sense for me. Someone like Darren Fletcher coming in, it's not a surprise at all. And I think it makes, it makes sense. And he's a manager that the fans, even if it is only for a short period, will get behind.
Right, OK. So it does now beg the question, of course, who could possibly take over permanently? And some of the names in the frame, Gareth Southgate. It is interesting, isn't it, how obviously he's been hugely successful, if not, winning as an England manager. Why is he never associated with top Premier League jobs? Or maybe this is the one he's going to get?
I'll be honest, I don't really want Gareth Southgate. And the
Why
reason
not?
Behind
that is, I don't get that. Why not?
Well, if you look at England, for example, right, and I get your point. He's done well at England. He got to a World Cup semi-final, I think, in his first tournament. He's been to a Euros final, two Euros finals. But international football is a lot different. You look at that first World Cup semi-final he got to, beating Tunisia, beating Panama, beating Colombia. These are good results, but does that mean you're a good Premier League manager? When he was in the Premier League, he got relegated with Middlesbrough, and then he got sacked when they were in the Championship. He's not managed in the Premier League, I think, for, over 10 years. So I'm not so sure that being a good international manager of England transfers to being a good manager at a club like Manchester United. We've had managers who've had lots of success. Jose Mourinho won the Premier League with Chelsea several times, came to Manchester United and ultimately struggled. So I just think giving someone a job based on what they've achieved as an international manager, someone who failed in the Premier League, for me, it's a bit of a risky one. And I don't think from the interactions I've had with Manchester United fans, it'd be a popular appointment.
All right, who do they want then?
Well, this is the problem. Not only is it who do they want, it's who would want to come to Manchester United at the minute, because we're a bit of a bin file. Managers keep getting sacked. The sort of the director of football seems to be at odds with the manager. So it's whether you could get sort of the manager that you'd want. I think a popular appointment would be someone like Unai Emery, but are you going to get him? Is he going to leave Aston Villa, where he's doing very well and the board seems to be on the same page as him, to come to somewhere like Manchester United with all the problems we've got, albeit no disrespect to Villa, we're a bigger club than they are. So I don't really think that's going to happen. Oliver Glasner's another name that gets bandied about. Just won the FA Cup, of course. Did quite well at Palace, but is that too big a step up going from somewhere like Palace, where the expectations are different, to somewhere like Manchester United? Xavi is another name that gets mentioned that I think would be relatively popular. I don't think there's a standout candidate, if I'm honest. I don't think there's one way to go. Everyone wants him and he'd be the one.
I know.
I think
that,
the big question is who would come.
Yeah, well, Jurgen Klopp says he wouldn't come back to the Premier League.
I don't think we're going to get Jurgen Klopp. It'd be funny if we did, just to see what the Liverpool fans thought about it. But I think even the most diehard United fan would admit we're not going to get someone who managed Liverpool for 9 years, whatever it was.
Why don't you just have a random selection? So of all of the Manchester United fans who have spent the last couple of years going, I could do a better job, just have a lottery and pick one of them.
That's a great idea. You know what? I think why not we could maybe have a little vote, a little lottery, and then, you know, they could have a go for a few weeks and see how they get on. Listen, you never put anything past Ineos.
Well, Fee and I'll do it.
We're free on Fridays.
Yeah, we are. We could do Fridays.
I mean, are you free on Fridays? Right, well, you could do Fridays job. And someone would pick it up on Monday.
Exactly. I mean, I'll tell you, I don't know what you think about what goes through the head of Sir Alex Ferguson when all these changes happen at Old Trafford. He must have a laugh to himself, mustn't he, Jay?
Well, I don't know if he has a laugh to himself, but he's just deflated. This is the club that he loves, a club that he built and made into the most successful in the Premier League, and it's just become a bit of a shambles and a laughing stock. So I think part of him is probably just deflated and disappointed. I remember when I was a kid, it was all the talk of someone being able to emulate Sir Matt Busby, and eventually Ferguson came along and did that. And I think Ferguson's probably looking at it going, when is this club going to sort itself out? I didn't leave a club in a bad state. I left us as champions. Mm. And ever since then, we've been a bit of a mess.
Yeah, well, let's hope, she said vaguely, for happier times ahead for fans of Manchester United.
I appreciate that.
Thank you, Jay. All the very best. Don says it's just wonderful to see Manchester United in chaos. Oh, Don, that's so petty. But I see what you mean. That was Jay Motti, host of Stretford Paddock.
Do you think that there needs to be a slight revision of what it is that it takes to be a really good Premiership manager? So you just look for a slightly different skill set?
So a different skill set. I just think football ultimately, Fee, is cyclical. And Manchester United did really, really well for a huge chunk of time under a genius of a manager in Sir Alex Ferguson, and they have never been able to emulate that success since. And why would they? Because these things come in waves, and sometimes you have amazing players, and they had loads of amazing local homegrown talent around that time. He was just an incredible person. He obviously could galvanise even the most recalcitrant player, and he had his methods, his hairdryer and all the rest of it, and nobody has been anywhere near him since. But then how could they be? Because he was genuinely uniquely gifted.
So you reckon come, 2035, we might be able to look at another Manchester United run?
Yeah, or potentially Hull City.
Maybe. Yeah, are there just any available women?
Well, Serena Wiegmann has yet to be approached, but it would be, you have to say, that would be the blockbuster showbiz appointment, wouldn't it?
We'd have so much to say about that.
Why not give it?
Why not?
Why not give it a whirl?
Yeah.
Proven success. Success, but I guess not at club level, as Jay himself said. So Gareth hadn't done it at club level.
Right, so they're just going to dunk another used tea bag in the cup. I'd say get a fresh one. Get a lady.
Almost 3 o'clock.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Women talking sport, it'll never catch on. Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. In the next hour of our programme, we'll assess how much the illegal drug trade controls Venezuela and why it's led to the removal of its president. Should Botox and fillers be considered high-risk procedures? Beauty industry leaders want the government to act. And it's the busiest time of the year to book a summer holiday. Money man Adam Shaw will tell us how to grab ourselves an early bird bargain. Get your towel on the sun lounger. Let's get the news with Stuart Willey.
Fee, thank you. Good afternoon. Venezuela's president, Nicolás Maduro, has been transported to a New York court to face drug charges after being taken from Caracas by US forces on Saturday. Pictures show him handcuffed and surrounded by armed officers. Here, the prime minister has again refused to be drawn on whether the American operation broke international law. He's under pressure from Labour MPs to condemn it. So Keir Starmer says nobody will shed tears for Maduro.
Well, the most important thing in Venezuela is a transition to democracy, a peaceful transition. The anchor has to be international law, right, as you'd expect me to say. The situation is complicated, and obviously the US will want to justify its
actions. But has it violated international law?
Well, the framework has to be international law. It's a complicated situation.
A former history teacher who pretended to be a Navy admiral has pleaded guilty to wearing military uniform without permission. 64-year-old Jonathan Carley was charged after attending a remembrance ceremony in North Wales last November. He's been fined £500. The Duke of Marlborough has denied strangling his estranged wife. 70-year-old Charles Spencer Churchill is accused of striking and intentionally strangling Edla Marlborough 3 times in 18 months. He indicated he'll plead not guilty when he appears in court again next month. Man's been arrested after windows were smashed at a home in Ohio belonging to the U.S. vice president. The Secret Service says J.D. Vance and his family weren't at the property in Cincinnati when the incident occurred last night. Police are deciding whether to charge a suspect with causing property damage. 10 people have been found guilty of cyberbullying France's First Lady Brigitte Macron. The legal action was sparked by false claims the French president's wife was born a man. The defendants, 8 men and 2 women aged between 41 and 60, have been handed a variety of sentences. New powers have come into force allowing mobile phones and SIM cards to be taken from migrants who enter the UK on small boats. The government says it's part of a plan to tackle crossings and could provide useful intelligence on smuggling gangs. Here's Home Affairs commentator Danny Shaw.
There'll be a lot of information on those phones about how they got into the boats. There may be some intelligence that will link back to the gangs who are organising this. That could help the French authorities and so on. So an important power. I don't expect it's suddenly going to reduce the boat crossings all of a sudden.
And scientists have developed an electronic nose that could sniff out cancer to improve diagnosis. It's been developed by training artificial intelligence to mimic dogs' responses to samples. Rob Harris is head of biodetection at the Medical Detection Dogs charity. He told Times Radio the dogs perform very well.
We tend to work with the gun dog group, so Labradors and Spaniels, mainly because a few generations they've been, you know, developed to work alongside people, but also to have a real good focus on using their nose and find it really enjoyable to search for things and detect them. The reliability is over 75%.
For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker,
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Almost 4 minutes past three, we are going to talk about the regulation of the beauty industry, about Botox and butt lifts. That's much more Fee's territory than mine, and that's why she'll be doing that item at around about a quarter past three. First, though, let's talk about the main news of the day. The former Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, is in New York ahead of his court hearing. He's due in court round about 5 o'clock our time. You'll hear coverage of that with John Pienaar here on Times Radio. He is facing narco-terrorism charges after his capture by the US over the weekend. Sir Keir Starmer is so far refusing to say if he believes that President Trump's actions break international law. The Chinese are demanding that the US release Maduro. Well, Julia Buxton is Professor of Law and Justice Studies at Liverpool's John Moores University. Professor Buxton, good afternoon to you. First of all, what could a British Prime Minister say in these highly unusual circumstances?
Well, we'd be hoping for some very strong language from Keir Starmer, really. I mean, this is in the UK neighbourhood. This impacts the Caribbean region, Trinidad and Tobago and Guyana, which is right next door to Venezuela. So it's really quite extraordinary. Also, the UK holds over £1 billion worth of Venezuelan gold. We have a very important vested interest and a voice in US action in Venezuela. And it's very, very disappointing that we've not had this expressed by Keir Starmer.
All right, let's have a listen to exactly what he said. He was asked a question by Sky's Beth Rigby about whether President Trump had violated international law. This is what he said.
Well, international law is really important. It's the framework, and it's for the US to set out its justifications for the actions that it's taken. But it is a complicated situation. It remains a complicated situation.
So you're not going to say whether you think the
most important thing. The most important thing is stability and that peaceful transition to democracy. That's what matters to Venezuela above all else.
Yes, I mean, I think you'd have to say that's somewhat mealy-mouthed, Professor. What do you say to that?
Oh, yeah, it's completely unacceptable and quite disappointing that a human rights lawyer, the best that they can suggest, is that perhaps this is a violation of international law. I understand that the UK government is waiting for the Trump administration to present its justification for this invasion. Trump's been very careful not to present this as being actual war or a direct conflict with Venezuela. They're using the mechanism of charging Maduro, as you know, with narco-terrorism charges. But the reality is that Trump is less convinced of the importance of convincing the US Congress of the legitimacy of these actions than he is Keir Starmer. So we're really not going to get this declaration from the US. So I'm quite unsure what Starmer's waiting for.
Yeah, I mean, not everybody's on the fence. Sir Emily Thornberry, a Labour MP, and she's chair, isn't she, of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. She says she doesn't think it's legal. So she's absolutely come out and said that.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, it's not a difficult question in terms of the violation of the territory.
Oh, no, that's annoying. I think we might have lost Julia Buxton. Have we lost her?
Territorial integrity of Venezuela under Article 2 of the law. Sorry.
Go on.
Shall I carry on?
Yes, if you don't mind, Julia. Apologies.
Yes. Yeah, sorry. I mean, it's obviously a violation of the United Nations Charter, Article 2, the territorial integrity of Venezuela. If the US is going to, you know, suggest that it's perfectly legitimate to intervene and arrest the president in this way, then rightfully it's been suggested the US should be charged with kidnapping unless it can clearly demonstrate that there is a legal basis for its intervention. But I don't think necessarily we should get wrapped up also in a lot of these debates and arguments about whether this is a legal intervention. The reality is it's a disastrous intervention for the United States, and we are really going to see this unravel, I think, over the next few days.
Right. Well, you say disastrous. The people of Venezuela, on the whole, generalisation alert, appear to be glad to see the back of him. Isn't that significant?
Oh, of course it is. You know, it's not a case of, you know, these things can't all be the same at the same time. You can be appalled by the way Nicolas Maduro has acted, but also deeply concerned at the manner of this US intervention. And essentially what the US has done, and it's quite remarkable from Trump, really, is that it's completely bypassed any regime change effort. Maria Corina Machado was the leader of the opposition. It was expected that she would be kind of leveraged into the presidency by Trump and by the US. But she's been completely bypassed because Trump has decided that he doesn't want boots on the ground in Venezuela. So what he's left Venezuelans with is this kind of decapitated regime, which is all still intact. You know, they still control the army, the police, the state economy, the bureaucracy, the Congress, regional government. So, you know, this has been a very, very problematic intervention, and we're really in this kind of limbo right now, which is of no benefit to Venezuelans at all.
Right. I mean, you say the whole situation is going to unravel in the next couple of days, I think was what you said. How will that look?
Well, the problem right now is that, you know, Venezuela has not been able to bring imports into the country. It doesn't have access to its oil economy. We've had this embargo recently on oil leaving Venezuela and an air and shipping blockade that's been carried out by the United States. So the challenge right now is, having removed the leadership of Venezuela, Donald Trump is kind of stepping back and saying our key priorities right now, his statement recently, it's not the human rights issue and the release of political prisoners, it's sorting out the oil economy. Another statement today saying it's the absolute priority right now is for Venezuelans to return to Venezuela from the United States, Venezuelan migrants. So what the US is essentially doing is putting in action a train of, you know, kind of policy and strategic directions. But until we can get into Venezuela, food, imports, medication and security over the next couple of days, this is going to be quite a fragile situation.
Right. And the opposition leader, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, does anybody know where she is?
She had gone to Norway to collect the Nobel Peace Prize, but really hasn't been seen since. It was reported that she'd been injured in this effort to get out of Venezuela and get to Norway. So
was presumably facilitated by the US, was it?
Well, we assume so, because otherwise she would have run the risk of being bombed by the US, given that she was going in a boat through the Caribbean. So that would have had to have been coordinated with the US, absolutely. The US has killed 115 people in the Caribbean recently in small boat bombing, so she would have had to notify.
At that point, then, you assume that the US administration were betting on her, and then they changed their mind?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, clearly the FIFA Peace Prize winning president has triumphed over the Nobel Peace Prize winning president. Right. So this is a real Peace Prize trade-off right now. The way Maria Corina Machado has been treated has really, you know, taken quite a few people by surprise here. But what Trump is calculating, if he had taken Maria Corina Machado, you know, into Venezuela, leveraged back into power, there would have had to have been very, very substantial US support in order to secure Maria Corina Machado, basically. And Trump's basically not willing to do that. This is a purely transactional operation. It's about access to oil in the economy. And if he can make a deal with the existing Venezuelan government, Maduro's vice president, that's the direction he's going to go.
Now, you've mentioned oil. It's obviously behind all this. I'm constantly reading that Venezuela has the largest crude oil reserves on the planet. What does that mean?
It means it's got 300 billion barrels worth of oil, mainly concentrated in its Orinoco Basin. But the real problem for Venezuela is that its oil is a very, very heavy crude mix. It's incredibly expensive to get out of the ground. And right now we have a glut in terms of oil supply on international markets. So, you know, Trump is really pushing this idea that oil is going to be the motor of Venezuela's economic development. But frankly, investment in Venezuela's oil sector right now is not an attractive proposition.
Because the situation is so unstable.
Well, because the oil infrastructure is going to need so much investment, it's going to require a long-term commitment from oil companies. And frankly, oil companies have far better environments to be operating in than Venezuela right now.
So the narco-terrorism charges that Maduro is facing at around about 5 o'clock our time, how significant is that? And what about the involvement of the state of Venezuela in the illegal drug trade impacting the states?
OK, well, we're much looking forward to hearing the evidence which is going to be presented against Nicolas Maduro. My personal view is that we've had this kind of framework of Maduro as a narco-terrorist created in order to justify US intervention. They can do this on the basis that this is taking out a terrorist involved in the drug trade. The reality is infinitely more complicated, and this is the danger of the US position. Venezuela has really negligible amounts of cocaine flowing through the country. It lives next door to the world's leading producer of cocaine, which is Colombia, but that cocaine transits to the US via the Pacific, traditionally through Colombia and not through Mexico. Fentanyl, the other great problem that the US has, a problem that first emerged within the US from the Sackler family and the whole OxyContin scandal there, Venezuela is not a producer of fentanyl. So really, Venezuela is marginal in the drug trade. We do hear that this regime is being propped up by narco funding. The reality is cocaine is at the lowest price in history. I mean, the price of cocaine is on the floor right now. It might be worth, £30,000 a kilo when it arrives here in the UK, but it's only worth £2,000 a kilo when it leaves Venezuela. It's not a lucrative commodity and it cannot sustain regimes.
Right. I mean, it's actually a fantastic time to be you, isn't it? Professor of Law and Justice Studies. You must, every day is Christmas Day for you at the moment, because, I mean, what's going to happen in terms of China and Taiwan and obviously Zelensky's future as the president of Ukraine, what will Putin be thinking right now? This is such a complicated picture, isn't it?
Oh, it really is. But I think what's been quite interesting, there's been a lot of suggestions and concerns that this sets a precedent for China, as you suggested, to take some kind of action in Taiwan and similarly with Russia in the Ukraine. I actually think China is an infinitely more sophisticated actor than that. And what China's doing right now is positioning itself in some respects as a champion of the international rule of law and highlighting how the US is really violating these standards. They call for Maduro to be released. They've been very, very clear that they are leaning into international law here in demanding the territorial integrity of Venezuela. So there's a dangerous precedent being set, but I would argue it's a precedent that really is one very much for the United States and we might see replicated in other countries.
And I'm just looking at images on the screens here of the UN Security Council meeting on Venezuela. Do you think that will achieve anything?
It will probably just result in a condemnation of US actions, but the UN Security Council really has been very, very ineffective in some of the most terrible and heart-wrenching crises of our modern times. So we can't really expect anything. Obviously, the US has a veto on the UN Security Council, so there'll be condemnation, but very little will come out from that body.
And how do you think the government in Denmark is feeling right now in terms of the future of Greenland?
I imagine that Denmark is probably feeling rather alienated from its NATO allies and very disappointed that countries like the UK and France haven't come out more strongly in defence of the basic principles of international law and the territorial integrity of nations. So a very, very worrying time for Denmark, for sure.
Thank you. That's Julia Buxton, Professor of Law and Justice Studies at Liverpool John Moores University.
That takes us to 3:15. Our WhatsApp this afternoon, 0333 003 2353. We've had a slew of jokes from Will this afternoon. Many thanks for all of them. I'll just do the top one. Low cocaine prices are not to be sniffed at. Coming up, fillers in your lunch hour, a butt lift on your day off. These aren't treatments that should be taken so lightly. We'll talk next to the beauty industry head, who says tighten the laws around tightening our bodies. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
John Pienaar on Times Radio, telling the stories that matter.
So what is really happening, or rather in many, many cases not happening, and why?
Intelligent analysis.
I will get you the full picture of this crisis, and I guess we can use that overused term given these facts.
And diverse opinion.
It is perfectly reasonable to object strongly to what happened, and joining that chorus is surely covered by the right to free speech.
John Pienaar at Drive, this afternoon from 4 on Times Radio.
Incredible snorkeling.
Carnival!
Sunrises and sunsets.
Grilled lobster.
Copycats and kayaking.
Morning swim.
Pina coladas.
Serene spas. If you love the sound of a Caribbean holiday, then Sandals have every little thing covered. Do it all or do nothing at all. Your perfect holiday is waiting at sandals.co.uk. Sale now on. Atoll protected.
What's the feeling you get at David Lloyd Clubs? Well, let's just say that when you've experienced the tranquility of our spas, felt the feel-good intensity of a workout class, enjoyed your little one's happy faces, making friends in the kids' club, and relaxed together as a family in our club rooms, this radio ad won't be the only thing on air. Elevate your everyday with David Lloyd Clubs. Try a 3-month membership today. Terms and conditions apply.
At Aberdeen Investment Trusts, we create more ways for your money to work harder. Whether you're looking to tap into global markets or target specific goals at any stage of life, we have options for you. With Aberdeen, our investment knowledge and experience become yours. Search Aberdeen Investment Trusts online to learn more. When investing, please remember that your capital is at risk.
Issued by Aberdeen Fund Managers Limited.
Download the Free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. The kitchen sale is now on. Plan your new kitchen with an expert design consultant. Hurry, the early bird discount ends soon. Browse all the kitchen offers at wix.co.uk. Terms apply.
Now, you can still make a difference to people's lives this Christmas season by supporting The Times and the Sunday Times Christmas Appeal, partnering with the charities World Bicycle Relief, Kissing It Better and Switchback. It's a fantastic opportunity to support those in need across the festive season. It isn't too late to donate, even though we said goodbye to Christmas and farewell to the new year.
We really have.
We really have. It's in the long rearview mirror now. So please find the time to visit thetimes.com/Christmas Appeal, or you can call 0151 286 1594. If you've got a little bit of generosity still left in you, why not pop it in that direction?
Right. I don't know about you, Fee, but our street is littered with discarded Christmas trees.
Yes.
It's a sad sight. The first one I noticed was lobbed into touch on the 27th. It did strike me as perhaps somebody
that's
hadn't
quite
had,
eager, isn't it?
They hadn't had the greatest festive season, but who amongst us did have? Coming up after 3:30 this afternoon, we are talking books with the fabulous Robbie Millen. He's got a couple of classics to discuss today, as well as the new one from, and I've completely forgotten who it is, but I know, Lionel Shriver. So Robbie Millen with us after 3:30. The podcast Off Air with Jane and Fee comes your way. It sort of staggers interviewed around 6 o'clock Monday to Thursday. Now, this time, on today's edition, we've been talking about hair transplants, Imodium, and a very high-level critique of a film we both endured over the festive period, Marty Supreme. We didn't go together. In fact, Fee didn't even see it to the end. I did. You can hear all of our 3:30 interviews in full as part of Off Air. And lately, we've had some crackers, Susie Wolfe, Spencer Matthews, Paul Feig, and recently Fee talked to Chris McCausland. Now, Chris is blind, and he presented a documentary which explored advancements in AI and also discussed how AI can help people with disabilities like himself. Here is Chris explaining how he uses ChatGPT to help him do something as simple as choosing an outfit in the morning.
It's like having a person with you. And if you don't point out that it's AI and people aren't aware of what AI is capable of, they think I've got my wife on FaceTime or something like that, because it's talking to me like there's a person looking through the camera on the phone, and it's describing clothing, whether it needs ironing, whether it's, you know, whether it looks clean. I show it an old band t-shirt from the Deftones, you know, an old, metal band, and it even comments, oh, what a nostalgic t-shirt. It's a good t-. It's nuts when people see it in action. And this is, you know, ChatGPT came out 3 years ago, really. And it's already at the point where it's mind blowing. And you know, this was just using ChatGPT on its video setting through its iOS app on the iPhone. It's already bananas. It's the worst it's going to be. It's only going to get better at these things. It was to show people really what it is capable of and how it can change people's lives.
You were saying it's quite nice to get a positive spin on AI, isn't it?
It was really refreshing. Mm. And Eve, our podcast producer, and I both left that interview with a slightly changed opinion about AI. And Chris is a very clever man, so he's not on the payroll of any of these companies. He's not been given Meta glasses in order to talk nicely about Meta. He is a very discerning person, and his experience with so many things at the forefront of technology are very different to our experience. We have the luxury of these being added extras in our lives. Mm. And there's one point in the documentary, Jane, where he goes in a driverless car, a Waze car in San Francisco, and he goes with another visually impaired friend of his, and she explains just how imperative these cars are to her daily life for getting around San Francisco. And then she gets out of the car and Chris is left in a car, and he says it's the first time in his entire life that he has been in a moving vehicle by himself.
Wow.
And the joy that he experiences, and he talks about his feeling of freedom and independence. It's real proper kind of tingles stuff. And of course, there are loads of things wrong with AI. We know that. But it is quite helpful to look at the momentum that's carrying progress in the right direction.
No, it's good. So the future is not all bad, Shock. You can listen to Chris talking to Fee as part of Off Air. That's a recent episode. You can download that and so many thousands of others wherever you get your podcasts from.
No exaggeration was included in that sentence at all.
Actually, it's, hardly any.
It's 3:23. Beauty industry leaders are calling for Botox and filler injections to be categorised as high-risk procedures. Several recent reports have revealed dark practices and a black market for treatments. And the public appears firmly on side. 96% of voters in a live poll on the Times website agree. The government's beginning to end, is trying to end, a race to the bottom. We laughed about that many times in the production office. I cannot believe that line made it through to the show. In safety standards as part of a push to end a profits over standards culture. Leslie Blair is the chief executive of the British Association of Beauty Therapy and Cosmetology, one of the women championing the change in regulations. Leslie, a very good afternoon from us.
Hi, ladies. How are you?
Yes, we're very well indeed. Tell us a little bit about the evidence that you gave to the Equality Select Committee in October.
Okay, so we did it in October in Westminster and then again in December at Scottish Parliament, which was great, just to get the message across. And I think it's really highlighting the need for everyone to know about all these different modalities that are out there, that we need the government to really step in and take account. I do love this race to the bottom. That was my colleague Victoria used that line, and I think it was really, really apt, because we are in an industry that we are kind of fighting just to make sure the standards are out there, but safety more than anything. So we were more than delighted to be able to go, give evidence to both select committees, just to show the support that we've got for any sort of oversight, licensing or control of this part of the industry.
And Leslie, what are the current licensing rules around Botox and filler injections in particular?
Not really very much, unfortunately. For botulinum toxin or trade name Botox injections, there needs to be a prescription and there needs to be some sort of medical oversight. For filler injections, that's a totally different scenario. There is no oversight needed at all. So this was what makes it a bit like the kind of Wild West out there. A lot of people can be doing these treatments without any oversight at all.
And when we're talking, Leslie, can we just be clear about this for people who don't have experiences of the needle? When we're talking about fillers, what exactly are we talking about? What is the procedure?
So lip fillers, having any injectable into the lips to make them look bigger, into the cheeks. So any kind of filler or injectable on the face for facial enhancement, whereas botulinum toxin would be wrinkle relaxing to, you know, stop crow's feet, lines, etc. on the face. So both we would class as medical procedures. And this is why BABTAC are championing that we have this, that it has medical oversight or actually performed by medical practitioners.
How can it be that these procedures involving stuff being injected into the human body have not been subject to any kind of licensing before? I mean, it seems almost ridiculous, doesn't it?
It's baffling. It's something that on a daily basis, this is what I kind of put my head in my hands on a daily basis with it. And my kind of favourite saying is we're emptying the ocean with a thimble here, because I think it's got quite far that there's so many people doing it now that it's going to be very, very difficult to kind of mop it up and to try and get those standards there. And this is why we need a really robust licensing or law behind it to govern who is actually doing these protocols, etc.
I mean, obviously, what I was going to say is
the problem for us, you know, there's a lot of people that are injectors who are excellent in what they do, who are non-medics. However, the problem we've got is if a problem arises, we are not qualified or able legally to write the prescription for the antidote for the problem. So if you have a problem to botulinum toxin, if you have anaphylaxis, you need to be able to administer adrenaline very, very quickly in order to save the person from anaphylactic shock. From a filler complication, it can cause an occlusion, which is a blockage in the artery, stops the oxygen from going there and it makes the tissue go into necrosis, dead. It kills the tissue. You need hyaluronidase injected within minutes in order to stop this complication from becoming very serious. We are not able to do that if we are not a prescriber. And right, that's been our argument from the beginning.
Well, I'm very glad that you explained the very serious nature of these complications. Yeah. In fact, a woman, I think called Alice, is believed to have become the first person in the UK to die after a BBL. A BBL is a Brazilian butt lift.
Yeah.
And these are included under the umbrella term of fillers, aren't they? And actually,
yeah, they should be banned. I think that as well, that protocol and procedure is very, very dangerous. And we would kind of really, really kind of champion that wasn't something that was available. We are also championing that some of the procedures out there, thread lifts, microcoring, are done by actual surgeons. So not just doctors and nurses, we want these to become surgical procedures as well. So there's a massive, massive remit out there. And we just feel my kind of favourite one again is stay in your lane. Let's all do what we're able to do. I feel everyone should be able to train to do any different protocol or procedure, but we've all got to have the correct oversight, understanding, qualification behind it.
Do you feel that you're something of a lone voice within your own industry, Leslie?
No, we've got great support. Ourselves, along with British Beauty Council Victoria and myself, do a lot of championing together. And I think we've got real buy-in from the industry. And I think that I know from our members, because we are very, very strict on who we take on board. We only insure qualified beauty therapists, which a lot of other insurers don't. They will insure people that don't have qualifications, which is another can of worms and another problem. But I think, especially from our members, we've got such a buy-in, and from other industry bodies, that we all want this. We want it for safety. We don't want anyone not to be able to earn money, but there's so many different ways in this industry that you can earn money.
Do you know what? When I started looking into this, I've not had any procedures done myself, nor would I want to. And that's, you know, it's not because
I'm the same.
It's obviously, but I've just been born with natural beauty.
All three of us are in that category.
Yeah, there's nothing anyone can do to improve it. So I was absolutely flabbergasted. Trust me, that is not a truth I've just said there. When I typed in, where can I get a Brazilian butt lift near me, about an hour and a half ago in the production office, the salon that comes up, which is just around the corner, promises me that I will be able to return to work in 45 minutes. The procedure won't hurt. I can pay in installments. There is no accreditation on the pages of the website. In fact, the only endorsement is from a woman called Penelope H, made up, who says, highly recommended. I've been receiving so many compliments on my new look. So as a punter, Leslie, your description of what is needed is light years away from what I am seeing when I first make contact because of my curiosity, vanity, insecurity, or whatever. Yeah.
And this is the problem. We've got the problem of social media, that we are seeing this ideal of what perfection should look like. And I think that people, they see the price, they see it looks cheap, they're seeing false claims, etc., without any of the risks that can potentially arise from it. And this is where that we are kind of crying out for, that we want this information to be mandatory anywhere, any clinic, any salon that is doing any treatments, that all the risks, etc., have got to be in there as well, and the correct people doing it, and the correct clinics and surroundings that any of these treatments are taking place in. For example, if you are going for a more surgical procedure, it should be in a surgical setting. If you're going for a more clinical procedure, it should be in a clinic setting. Not quite in a sitting room in somebody's house getting surgical treatments done. Mm. So that's the other thing that we're really championing for, is the clinics and the premises, salons, etc. So if you're going for skin needling, etc., have it in a beauty salon. Beauty therapists are more than qualified to be doing skin needling, skin peels, etc., at a certain level. We've got the more advanced, that you maybe need some medical oversight, maybe would need to be done in a medical clinic, etc., etc.
Leslie, just a quick one from me. What is the official accreditation that somebody new to this area should look out for? How do I know that the salon that, as Fee was saying, near me is a good one that might be able to give me a decent set of buttocks?
Right, well, I would strongly recommend that you didn't go because...
And believe me, I won't be going, but...
Because you're perfect, you don't need it.
Yeah.
But I think as well, this is off-label use for filler. Filler is not meant to be used to be injected into the buttocks. So I think for us, for a beauty treatment, if you come onto BabTac's website, we have got a list of... we can tell you where the salon, the correct salons are, etc. We can guide you in the correct direction. But I think for all of these other protocols, I wouldn't even know where to start.
No, so just don't do them.
No, but you're doing very valuable work, Leslie. Will you keep in touch and we will talk
please
again?
Please do.
Yeah, that's
perfect.
Leslie Blair, who's the Chief Executive of the British Association of Beauty Therapy and Cosmetology. That is the organisation that you need to look out for. So BABTAC.
What?
So she said BABTAC. That's the acronym, BABTAC.
Right, we've got to stop talking. It's just after 3:30. Here are the headlines. Times Radio, Stuart Willey.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. Venezuelan authorities have ordered police to find and arrest anyone involved in supporting the US abduction of Nicolás Maduro. It comes as the UN Secretary General says he's worried the operation didn't respect the rules of international law. Here, the Prime Minister again wouldn't be drawn on that, but he has spoken out against Trump's suggestion he could annex Greenland. The Times' political editor is Stephen Swinford.
He's clearly picked a side on this and actually is standing up for Greenland there and echoing what the Danes are saying, which is hands off. Mm. So, you know, that is different from what we saw with Venezuela, where they are at pains to say absolutely nothing about whether this is legal or illegal for risk of angering Donald Trump.
The first Palestinian embassy in the UK has officially opened. The site in West London has been upgraded to full diplomatic status after the British government recognised the state of Palestine last September. Ruben Amorim has been sacked as the boss of Manchester United after 14 months in charge. He's parted ways with the club after hitting out at the club's owners yesterday. A second man's been arrested in connection with a shooting in southeast London. The 34-year-old is being questioned on suspicion of attempted murder. And a man who dressed up as a Royal Naval officer on Remembrance Sunday says he was seeking belonging. 65-year-old Jonathan Carley from Northwest Wales has been fined £500 after admitting wearing military uniform without permission. For a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
I always enjoy going back to my childhood home to see Mum and Dad, but as they get older, the more and more guilty I would feel, you know, about leaving them on their own, especially in winter when it's so cold and miserable outside. I visit as often as I can with the rest of my family, but Mum and Dad really need someone around who can help them more regularly than we can. So thank goodness for Ellie. She's their care professional from Home Instead, and she actually lives with Mum and Dad, which means she can be there for them whenever they need her. It gives us real peace of mind. Mum and Dad really don't want to leave their home, and we don't want them to either. So living care from home instead was the perfect solution for us. It's been amazing. And Ellie's made such a difference to their lives too. They are so much happier, so much better in themselves. So now, whenever I visit them, they don't feel like Mum and Dad who need to be looked after. They feel like my parents again.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
The Hilton sale is now on, and thankfully it doesn't sound like this. Instead, our sale sounds a bit more like this.
Welcome back.
With a warm welcome, spacious rooms, central locations, and up to 20% off your stay. You can swap chaos for comfort this winter. Book now at hilton.com. Hilton, for the stay. Offer subject to availability across participating hotels. Terms and conditions apply.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Our literary salon has reopened for the year of 2020. Seamless.
Some chilly air has blown in.
Oh. Nobody would have noticed. If you have any brie and crackers left, now is the time, apparently. I'm not a big fan of brie.
No.
It's a bit like glue, don't you think? Hello, Robbie Millen.
Yeah, no, it's the last bit at the end that dries up. That's the horrible bit, and it goes a bit brown.
Rindy bit. Okay.
Yes.
But I've become a big fan of Shropshire Blue.
That give you slightly kind of racy dreams?
No. It's a little bit like Stilton, but it's orange.
Okay. Mm. Does anything give you racy dreams?
No. Okay. Although actually... No. Oh,
I feel like I should leave now. I didn't expect to be that kind of show.
Please don't. It's Jane's first day back after a long time away, so we're a little bit giddy, Robbie. A little bit giddy. Right, you want to tell us about Lionel Shriver's Better Life, out this February.
Exactly. So do you know what? Lionel Shriver, her sort of great gift is choosing really brilliant, timely subjects. So this one's about immigration. Sort of a bit controversial, isn't it? So, I mean, the setup of the novel is a New York, Brooklyn family, quite sort of big house, you know, quite wealthy, progressive, middle class. They decide to take in a Honduran refugee, but things go wrong and more than one arrives and so on.
What do you mean more than one arrives?
Well, then all of a sudden a so-called brother arrives. Oh. And then it sort of all snowballs from there. Mm. So, Lionel Shriver's got quite sort of right-wing views on immigration, so they appear in it. But she also has characters express other views. And this is quite an interesting way, using fiction, this is one of the great things about novels, to explore kind of a contentious subject. Because you think her previous ones, like Big Brother, about the obesity epidemic, the motion of the body through space, was all about our obsession with fitness culture. So she hits on these kind of really interesting issues where they're kind of ambient.
Okay. And that's out in February.
That's out at the beginning of February.
Something to look forward to then, if you want your mind a little bit provocatized. What's the right word? Provoked. Yes.
But, you know, it was quite nice sort of escaping over Christmas to read some old stuff. For instance, can I segue neatly?
You can segue, but I've got a little bit of a theory that you're all obsessed. What floor of this building are you on?
Oh, floor 11.
Floor 11 is obsessed with the Castlereagh Chronicles.
We are.
Yeah.
Do you know
why?
It's because it's brilliant. Do you know what? Funny enough, just before Christmas, I started reading the first volume, Elizabeth Jane Howard's. There are five volumes, The Cazalet Chronicles, all about a family called the Cazalets, who are kind of sort of upper class. They have a big house in Sussex and one's nice, one's in Notting Hill.
I'd like to listen or read a book about people with small houses.
Oh, God, no.
Okay, right. Never catch on.
No, boring. All right. No, so this, it's a big family and they've got a servant, so we get beneath stairs. And it's just sort of following them from the late 30s, just before the Second World War. And Elizabeth Jane Howard, who had been married to Kingsley Amis, goes into the 1950s. But weirdly enough, a couple of other colleagues who sit one to my left and one further to my left, we both started reading at the same time.
Yeah, so is one of them Laura Hackett? Because I think
Well, Laura Hackett's opposite, and she's just finished them.
Oh, see? It's extraordinary. Kind
of, but I tell you what it is.
It's a contagion.
It's a contagion, because I think there's a real absence of novels which are kind of family sagas, which take you across time. Lots of characters, but not too many that you kind of get confused who they are. Because she does do a little family tree at the front of each volume. And it's just really absorbing. So you also you get a child's eye view of a situation or a sort of elderly person.
And so did Elizabeth Jane Howard write them very much across her whole lifetime, well, or as a bulk one?
Well, she sort of started in 1990 and she knocked out the first... Knocked out, you know what I mean?
That's not how she saw it.
She quickly wrote the first four over the next few years. And then there was quite a long break before the last one came out in 2013. I think she was 89.
Golly,
and then she died the next year. Yeah. Job done. But is it job done? Because, interestingly enough, her niece, Louisa Young, who's an established novelist in her own right, is writing a sixth, seventh and eighth volume. She's taking on the Cazalet name.
Into the 21st century.
Into the 21st, and that's in the second half of the year. I think it's called The Golden Hours. Oh.
So a friend of mine outside this building, not on the 11th floor, we were talking about the need at the moment to know that you can read a book that's safe. And by safe, I don't mean boring. Safe, just you're not going to find some kind of horrendous murder of a young woman halfway through, all the unreliable narrator stuff that we've had recently, whatever. And she highly recommended the Cazalet Chronicles for exactly that reason. But the worry is when you say that, you make them sound a bit dull, but they're not dull.
They are far from dull. They're just really teeming with incident. I think because, you know, you think over the last few weeks we've all been with our families or various bits of our family, and they kind of always, I don't know whether we're all sort of in a sort of family mode where you think about how the generations interact with each other, you know, people sort of dying and disappearing and the new generation coming up. It's kind of all sort of human life there.
Yeah. Okay. Notes on a Scandal by Zoe Heller. Now, this is a truly, truly brilliant novel, isn't it? I cannot believe that it's more than 20 years old.
I can't believe that either.
Yeah. Came out in 2003. The film, which you remember, I think Kate Blanchett in it.
Judi Dench.
Yeah. That came out 20 years ago. And for whatever reason, I've never read it, and I just sort of picked it up on a whim. It's terrific. It's so black and it's so funny. And I suppose people probably know a bit about it.
What's it remind us of the plot here?
It's essentially a teacher develops, a female teacher develops a relationship with a 15-year-old boy, and it all spirals out of control. But it's all narrated by a friend of the teacher, another teacher called Barbara Covett.
Who is Judi Dench in the film.
Yes, that's right. Okay. And she turns out, she's a marvellous old trout. She's so bitchy about other people, and she's quite a sour presence, but you don't quite realize how awful she is. It sort of develops over the course. She's a brilliant creation. It's so funny, and you know, Zoe Heller takes you somewhere you don't expect to go.
I think I might reread that.
It's really great.
Now, you have been enjoying William Boyd.
Well, I have read William Boyd's, I think they are his latest books, featuring new creation, Gabriel Dax, is an accidental spy.
Yes.
And I love William Boyd's writing at the best of times. Yeah. And what's remarkable about these two books is that they are set in the 1960s. They have themes of what the CIA might be doing, particularly in Central and South America. And obviously what happened in Venezuela. I've just finished the second book, which is called
The Predicament.
The Predicament. So Gabriel's Moon is the first one and The Predicament is the second one. All about Guatemala and the American involvement in that and why America might want to depose certain important people across the world and money comes into it. And it was just that extraordinary meeting of fact and fiction in the world. And I would highly recommend them. I think William Boyd's just such a master.
I think he does the sort of similar thing to Elizabeth Jane Howe, where he gives you a big story, lots of characters, but William Boyd, it's much more globe-trotting as well. He bounces around in all sorts of strange places.
He does. And in this book, he's got the most remarkable grasp of what everybody looks like and is wearing, particularly the women involved. And Faith Green is the kind of female protagonist, and she works for MI6. His detail of what she wears and how she wears it is just fantastic.
Do you know, I think we're all slightly bored of those little kind of modern anemic novels that sort of don't give you this kind
name
of rich...
One.
I forget them all, but there's a whole generation
of
them.
They're so forgettable.
Yeah,
who
cares?
Well, the ones where you get two whole pages about keeping a house plant alive in East London.
It's hard, though.
Now, you are... When did you spring off the high seas? Because you...
Oh, yes.
We do need to just nod to the fact that you went on the...
Gosh, it was about... I think I got off about December the 15th.
Right. So this was the Times... What is it exactly?
It's called the Cheltenham Literature Festival at Sea. And it's sponsored by the Times, the Sunday Times. And it's on the Queen Mary 2. And we travelled from the glamour of Brooklyn and New York to Southampton.
Wow.
Which amazing kind of beautiful Southampton.
Do you get that feeling coming into the Solent?
Yes.
Howard's Way.
It is. Oh, well, there's a great story. But it was really fun. Everyone puts on a huge amount of weight because you just drink and eat and drink and eat and drink and eat. And obviously attend really amazing talks by various great novelists and writers and journalists.
Sounds
possibly
amazing.
Including me.
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad you had a good time.
You should come.
No, I just... I cannot... And I think you're the same, aren't you?
I am the same.
I can't be on a ship that where you can't see land. I just wouldn't be able to do it.
It takes you away from all your problems.
What, the Atlantic in November? Okay, take your word for it.
Do you know what the sea is? Very hypnotic. Just that splish splash. Ooh. And it doesn't care... Isn't that very same
really,
like feeling?
You're really not selling it at all. So I'm just imagining being up on deck, just vomiting now. All right, thanks.
For what it's worth, we should say we've got Maggie O'Farrell on the programme tomorrow.
You're joking? That's a
good booking. Yeah,
yes.
I just wanted to mention that because you've done the interview already.
I have done the interview already because Hamlet opens in the Kinemas. Across the UK, and obviously that's based on her remarkable book about Shakespeare's wife. Not about Billy Shakespeare, but about Anne.
Yeah. Played in the film by... Is it Emily...
No, I'm going to
Emily
say...
Emily Watson, is
Emily
it?
Watson. I think it is. Yeah, it is. I think Robbie and I are right. Yes, anyway.
I bow to your grace and wisdom.
Yes, because I think she was interviewed in the Times very recently.
Yes,
I've booked tickets, but Fee has told me that it's an impossibly sad film and I haven't read the book.
Well, I mean, it's about the death of a child. It's about maternal grief.
Oh,
I mean, but it's about redemption as well.
Okay.
So I hope you'll be all right, Jane. I worry for you, though.
Well, I'm going.
It is a weep fest. I've heard of people coming back, but in a good way.
I cried a lot.
No bad thing.
Yeah.
Robbie, thank you very much. I did want to mention, I don't know if you've read this. Have you read A Schooling in Murder by Andrew Taylor?
He's a very good historical novelist.
Yeah, that's his latest sort of historical. It's set in a girls' boarding school in the dying days of World War II, and there's a murder, and the victim then tries to solve her own murder. It's rather clever. With a pretty, very good twist. Yes, I'd recommend that.
The victim tries to solve her own murder?
Yes,
what,
she's a
from
ghost.
The other side?
She's a ghost, yeah.
Oh.
Okay, so that's just my recommendation.
That's pretty good.
Thank you very much, Robbie. Robbie, I'm afraid we'll almost certainly be back.
Can we just say that we were talking about Lionel Shriver's A Better Life, which is out this February. We were talking about all of the volumes of The Castellet Chronicles by Elizabeth Jane Howard, Notes on a Scandal by Zoe Heller, and the latest two William Boyd books, which are Gabriel's Moon and
The Predicament.
Thank you.
And Vicky points out that Jessie Buckley actually plays Shakespeare's wife, and Emily Watson plays Shakespeare's mum.
Oh.
Yeah.
And Paul Mescal is in there as well.
I'm not thinking about him.
You will after you've seen it.
Right. Okay. It's Times Radio. It's 10 to 4.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
2026 has already been a huge year for big news stories. This has not been written by Donald Trump. We'll continue to bring you everything you need to know from 6 o'clock.
We'll get you the latest from Venezuela and we'll ask what's next for world order more generally.
Plus our leaders panel, William Hague and Kezia Dugdale, will be here in the studio from 9.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio. Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
In areas overwhelmed by conflicts and natural disasters, we can't miss a life-saving moment. As a doctor with Médecins Sans Frontières, I've seen how a moment lost can mean a life lost. Right now, MSF is working across the globe, providing maternity care, containing outbreaks, performing vital surgeries. We can't miss a life-saving moment. MSF needs help. Your help. Every attack, disease, and natural disaster puts more people at risk and calls for our teams to go further and faster. Medical emergencies move quickly. So must we. £50 will keep our work going and make a life or death difference. The life-saving moment is now. To give £50, call 0800 055 7979. That's 0800 055 7979. Or search MSF Urgent. Thank you.
Incredible snorkeling.
Carnival!
Sunrises and sunsets.
Grilled lobster.
Poppycats and kayaking.
Morning swim.
Pina coladas.
Serene spas.
If you love the sound of a Caribbean holiday, then Sandals have every little thing covered. Do it all or do nothing at all. Your perfect holiday is waiting at sandals.co.uk. Sale now on. Atoll protected.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
It is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk. Now, it's possible that over the course of the weekend, your thoughts may well have turned to a summer holiday. Millions of pounds worth of holidays were apparently booked at the weekend in what is expected to be a record year for travel. Travel companies got a name for the weekend rush. Apparently, it's called Sunshine Saturday, as thousands of people look to plan their summer getaways. Fiona, my colleague, has certainly been among that number. Travel companies expect that passenger demand has risen about 5%, but how do you get a bargain? Let's bring in Adam Shaw, who's our personal finance guru. Hello, Adam. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you.
Happy New Year. Can we just have a brief word, actually, about the amount of money we spend at the airport before we even got anywhere?
Yes.
Is that a wise move? I'm such a sucker for these places. I just love to... I go to Pret, I arm myself with a meaty baguette, and then I just spend loads of money on stuff I don't need. I getting a bargain?
No, you're definitely not getting a bargain, but you're in good company. I know if I take my family abroad, suddenly everyone finds an urgent need to buy humongous bags of minstrels and other things.
Yes.
And the companies know that. And therefore, this is one of the worst ways of buying stuff. MoneySupermarket.com did a bit of work on that. A share bag of M&Ms, I don't know whether you'll share them, but supposedly the size implies you should, mm-hmm. costs 50% more at an airport than at a supermarket. Bottled water, 60% more. A bottle of Coke Zero, which costs £2.20 in the shops, costs a little over £4 at the airports. And the comparisons go on and on. And, you know, so this is a terrible way of doing it. However, the flip side is you bring it all with you. I remember travelling with my Italian mother-in-law as a whole family, and she was a great chef. And she sort of made prosciutto sandwiches and arancino, and we were going, I think, EasyJet or Ryanair, and they separated all six of us. And so she would just pass, do you mind passing that back to my son-in-law five rows back? And so sort of prosciutto sandwiches were being passed amongst the travellers on this plane, all of who I thought, first of all, thought we were a bit mad, but also I think we're rather jealous of the fact we brought our food. Not only was it better, but we saved a huge sum of money.
So, and what about exchanging money? Is it ever wise to leave that until you're at the airport?
No, it's never wise to do that. And it varies bizarrely from airport to airport. One report by Eurochange found that Gatwick Airport is the worst for exchange. Travellers changing €500 there would have spent staggering. It's a lot of money. An extra £118.
What?
Because they missed the best deals. I mean, there's a separate issue here about whether you should take cash at all. I was in Italy recently and I literally needed to spend a penny or 50 cents and didn't have any cash with me. So that was rather problematic. So it is good to have some cash with you. But actually, cash, weirdly, is a usually rather an expensive way of spending abroad. Generally, it is generally better, or you get a better exchange rate, a much better exchange rate, if you use certain credit cards.
Right, I'm absolutely flummoxed. I assumed, and I'm so naive, that exchange rates in terms of getting your money at the airport would be standardised across the nation. I didn't realise...
Why would you assume that?
Well, because I'm a pillock. I mean, I didn't realise that Stansted could offer you one rate and Gatwick something else.
It's a free market, and because they know that you are now a pressured buyer because you're travelling. You go to the Foreign Exchange Bureau, presumably because you desperately need some money when you arrive and you want some cash in your hand. Therefore, you're a captive market. And so that's not the best way generally. Now, look, there may be some exceptions, but I've never seen any good deals. And all of the literature suggests this is a terrible way of buying your money. So you buy it early. If you really want to pick it up at the airport, I've seen some deals where you can book it online and pick it up at the airport and you get a better deal, even from the same company. But certainly, I would suggest never get your cash at the airport.
Right. And have you joined the Sunshine Saturday rush over the course of the last couple of days and booked your summer holiday?
I did it before then, actually. I do think, I always wonder why it is. Is it the weather or is it the fact everyone's had a terrible time enforced with their families and desperate to escape? And all the way through Christmas, they've been going, oh, come the summer, I'll be away from these people. I don't know. But I booked mine early. And actually, what's interesting is that you used to be able to get, I think, really good deals at the last minute. And I think the airlines have got really clever mathematicians now working out booking rates. And you rarely actually see underbooked aeroplanes or indeed overbooked aeroplanes. And so that's much rarer now. Mm. And so getting last minute deals can be problematic. The best time to book generally is at least a month in advance if you're going domestically, 60 days in advance for international flights. Expedia did some work on that and reckon you could save 10% on average if you booked 60 days in advance. And Which also did some research and they said you could save 176 pounds if you booked your holiday 8 months early. So although there are exceptions, generally booking early will get you the better deal.
OK, but are we talking about the old traditional package, or does it work out better for you if you book now and you actually are perfectly capable of booking your flight and getting your accommodation separately yourself?
Yeah, I think it refers to both. Of course, I know there is this tendency, and I'm the same, I book my stuff independently, but there are huge advantages of booking a package holiday. For instance, given all the travel disruption, if you book a plane and an Airbnb or a hotel separately and the plane gets delayed or cancelled, then you just lose the hotel. You've lost all that money. Mm. Whereas if you book a package, the whole thing is protected. So if one bit fails, the company is there responsible for either giving you your money back or getting you to the resort and making sure you can stay in your hotel. So there are lots of benefits of booking a package holiday, even though I think they've fallen a bit out of favour.
Yeah, they have a bit, haven't they? And I rather enjoy a package. I just think, I don't know, there's a certain amount of security around it, which I enjoy because I'm incredibly risk averse.
No, and I think that's perfectly, you know, that's a good deal. And you can get some good deals. I mean, I think if you book a resort holiday with all the food included, it can be a really economic way of doing it. And you're not getting second best. You can get really upmarket package holidays where if you booked each element individually, it would be much more expensive. Mm. And then you're going to resort, you're being looked after, everything's packaged for you. It feels a little less adventurous. But you pay your money, you take your choice. It depends what sort of holiday you want.
Very quick word on travel insurance. When is the best time to get that, Adam?
Yesterday. Always get it before you actually book the holiday, or at least when you book the holiday. Because if you don't and something happens before you fly, you lose everything. If you book it now or when you book your holiday, you're covered from that moment until the time you travel. So if anything happens, if a family emergency occurs, you're covered. Don't wait until the last minute. And generally, I would try and get multi-trip insurance, especially if you're booking rental cars. Rental car insurance, complete rip-off.
Good advice. Thank you, Adam. Maggie O'Farrell, our guest tomorrow. If you've read Hamnet, you'll want to hear her. Thank you for listening.
Our producer today, Rosie Cutler. Our tech operator was Ryan Boyden. Up next, it's John Pienaar.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio. The voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Venezuela orders police to find and arrest anyone involved in supporting the US abduction of Nicolás Maduro. And the first Palestinian embassy in the UK has officially been opened. And coming up, we'll bring you pretty comprehensive reaction and analysis to the American intervention in Venezuela and what it means for a new world order. We'll be hearing from The Times' Catherine Philp, the former Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, and the woman who was once Donald Trump's ambassador to Denmark. Does she think Greenland could and should be next? And we're going to be following the live events at the UN Security Council meeting taking place now, Nicolas Maduro's appearance in court in New York, and the Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper's statement to the House of Commons a little later on.
This is Times Radio.
Now the news with Stuart Woody.
John, thank you. Good afternoon. An emergency UN Security Council meeting on Venezuela has begun, with the Secretary-General warning that the US intervention is deeply concerning for international law. Vasily Nebenzia is Russia's ambassador to the UN. He called for the release of Nicolás Maduro.
The assault against the leader of Venezuela, compounded by the deaths of dozens of Venezuelan and Cuban citizens, in the eyes of many, has become a harbinger of a turn back to the era of lawlessness and U.S. domination by force, chaos, and lawlessness.
The ousted president is to appear in a New York court shortly to face drugs charges. Images show him handcuffed and surrounded by armed officers. Here, the prime minister has again refused to be drawn on whether the American operation broke international law. He's under pressure from some Labour MPs to condemn it. Sir Keir Starmer says nobody will shed tears for Maduro.
Well, the most important thing in Venezuela is a transition to democracy, a peaceful transition. The anchor has to be international law, right, as you'd expect me to say. The situation is complicated, and obviously the US will want to justify its
actions. But has it violated international law?
Well, the framework has to be international law. It's a complicated situation.
The first Palestinian embassy in the UK has officially opened. The site in West London has been upgraded to full diplomatic status after the government recognised the state of Palestine last September. Its ambassador, Hossam Zumlaat, says it's a profound milestone for both countries.
This is a day of hope, a day of steadfastness, and a day that reminds the world that peace is not only possible, it is inevitable.
Israel and the US have criticised the recognition of Palestinian statehood. The communications regulator has asked Elon Musk's social media site X to explain how its AI chatbot was able to produce sexualized images of children. Ofcom says it's aware of serious concerns over the feature and wants assurances the company is complying with their duty to protect users in the UK. A former history teacher who pretended to be a Navy admiral has pleaded guilty to wearing military uniform without permission. 64-year-old Jonathan Carley was charged after attending a remembrance ceremony in North Wales last November. He's been fined £500. In sport, Ruben Amorim's 14 months in charge of Manchester United is over. The club has sacked its head coach after comments he made appearing to criticise the owners after their 1-1 draw at Leeds yesterday. The team's former midfielder Darren Fletcher will lead them in Wednesday's match at Burnley. Former Premier League club owner Simon Jordan says Amorim has behaved poorly.
I think the idea that you can communicate to your people that you work for through the media, I think is unprofessional. You wouldn't want your players going out and saying something dreadful about you as a manager. So why would you expect a manager to be able to say something to the hierarchy, the real power in the room, and expect to get away with it?
For a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Now, who knows what the future holds for Venezuela now that President Trump is supposedly running or at least totally dominating the place? And what about the future now for Latin America, for the Western Hemisphere, including Greenland, and for that matter, the rest of the world? If only we had much of a clue what Donald Trump is thinking. Beyond laying claim to Venezuela's oil on behalf of the American oil giants, I mean, and beyond warning the newly installed president of Venezuela to do as he wants, whatever that is, or get the same treatment as Maduro, or worse, and beyond having his team mention the goal of a better future for Venezuelans, but without any plan or timetable for elections. Now, of course, when a country as powerful as America, with a leader as mercurial and unpredictable as President Trump, when everyone pays attention, when he hits at hitting Colombia next, or Cuba, maybe Mexico, So, come to think of it, it's just wrong to say we don't have a clue what President Trump is thinking. He's thinking aloud about dominating his half of the globe. What we don't know is how, or where it'll leave what's left of the Western Alliance and the rules-based world order. Or, frankly, whether the birth of a new world order really is a lurch into a new world disorder. Or is that too dark a thought? If you think it is, do please tell me why. Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or maybe a tweet to @TimesRadio. Now, as I'm speaking, the UN Security Council in New York is debating and will be voting on Venezuela. Many countries critical, a handful supportive of the president, and Britain, well, the UK, is abstaining apparently, tiptoeing the same diplomatic tightrope of not endorsing Trump's actions while trying hard to avoid upsetting him. And in about an hour, the captured and deposed Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro is appearing in a New York criminal court facing drug trafficking and firearms charges. We'll be watching that for you too. And a bit later on, MPs are going to be hearing the British government's take on it all in the House of Commons. Stay with me. I promise you will miss nothing. First, though, let's just get up to date with our top story. The UN Security Council meeting now. The Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, responded to the US attack on Venezuela. His Undersecretary, Rosemary DiCarlo, spoke on his behalf.
Rules of international law have not been respected with regard to the 3 January military action. The Charter enshrines the prohibition of the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state.
Well, now, Vasily Nebenzia, Russian's ambassador to the United Nations, has also been speaking at the UN. His words have been translated.
We hope that you will abandon double standards and that you will not attempt to justify such an egregious act of aggression due to a fear of angering the American global gendarme, which is attempting to once again rear its head. We are particularly appalled by the unparalleled cynicism with which Washington did not even attempt to conceal the true aims of its criminal operation, namely the establishment of unbridled control over Venezuela's natural resources.
And that Russian message was echoed by China's deputy UN envoy, the ambassador Geng Shuang.
No country can act as the world's police, nor can any state presume to be the international judge. China firmly supports the government and people of Venezuela in safeguarding their sovereignty, security, and legitimate rights and interests. We firmly support the regional countries in upholding the status of Latin America and the Caribbean as a zone of peace. We demand that the United States change its course, cease its bullying and coercive practices, and develop relations and cooperation with regional countries on the basis of mutual respect, equality, and non-interference in international affairs.
That's China's representative at the UN. Now let's just cross live to New York, where the American representative Mike Waltz is speaking.
Mr. President, thank you for chairing. And I particularly want to thank you, Mr. Freitas, for your briefing. And I'll point out that Mr. Freitas is in exile, having fled the regime.